Welcome to History's Nightfall podcast. My name's Dan Jones. I'm an author, broadcaster, and the historical consultant on Nightfall. And through the show's cast and crew, I'm here to delve into the medieval world that Nightfall creates. Now, as we say every episode, there are spoilers ahead. There are spoilers ahead. There are spoilers ahead. I've said it three times. If you don't understand there are spoilers ahead, then that's your lookout. Please be sure that you've caught up on the second episode before you continue to listen. Here's a little pause. Right, here we go. In this episode, I'll be speaking to the actors who portray our three main knights. That's Landry, Tancred, and Gawain, or as they're known in the real world when they're not wearing chainmail, Tom Cullen, Simon Merrells, and Porrig Delaney. And I'll be talking to them about the preparation they went through coming into the show. But first, let's recap on episode two. So the story continues. Now, Godfrey's body has been missing, but our Templars rescue it from an impromptu autopsy at the hand of a rabble of brigands. What were they looking for? We don't know. Not at this stage, anyway. Now, fighting ensues. As always, they're Templars, that's what they're for. Meanwhile, back in Paris, Pope Boniface arrives in the city with King Philip asking him to rule on the matter of his daughter's marriage. And I love to see Pope Boniface charging about the city, not least because when we first meet him and he's in this fantastic Pope-mobile, he goes around claiming Pope's privilege to do pretty much anything he wants. He's got clearly the biggest hat in the show, a sort of papal Easter bonnet, and my favourite thing of all, he's constantly dropping little snippets of Latin. Let's hear one.
Sancte Apostoli Petrus e Paulus.
Beautiful. Now, confirmed as the new master...
Where were you first prepared to lead the temple?
In my heart.
And where was that heart tested?
In the field of battle.
By the grace of God, rise, master of the temple.
Rise, master of the temple.
And find us the grail.
Landry immediately alienates Gawain, labelling the former top swordsman unable to carry out his duty.
It's become a hindrance.
And with Godfrey's body back in Paris, the Templars proceed to cut him open themselves, revealing a clue to tell them about the whereabouts of the Grail.
A key.
Now, in this episode, I want to zone in on the three Templar knights who we've been getting to know since we met them at the start of episode one. That's Landry, Tancred, and Gawain. So let's work out who they are and what makes them tick, or in Tom's case, the preparation that has led up to that absolutely amazing roar that Landry does every time he has to slice someone up. I can't do it myself. Let's hear Tom do it. It's a great roar. Now, for me, the first thing to say is that even having names for our Templars is kind of amazing. Because usually Templars aren't very well represented as real people, either in history or in fiction. So we've probably got a clear idea of the archetypal Templar knight. That's a sword-swinging monster in that iconic white outfit with the red cross on it. But I can only think of two or three Templars that most normal people, and I don't bracket myself in normal people here, might have heard of. I mean, there's Sir Brian de Bois-Guilbert in Ivanhoe, but actually we're not counting him because Sir Walter Scott made him up. So, when it comes to real, actual historical Templars, who have we heard of? Well, there's Hugh de Pan, who founded the order in 1119, 1120. There's Jacques de Molay, who oversaw its demise and got burned to death. I told you there were spoilers. And there's a master in the 12th century called Gerard de Riedfort, who was responsible for leading dozens and maybe hundreds of Templars to their deaths. Now, he pops up in films like Kingdom of Heaven and the computer game Assassin's Creed. So I guess he's doing well, and that counts for something. But speaking as a historian of the order, the anonymity of the rank and file of Templars gets kind of frustrating because actually over two centuries there was a massive range of people who did join the order, did serve in the order, whether as knights or Templar sergeants, as chaplains, associate brothers, or even occasionally sisters in the Order of the Temple. And all these people came from a huge range of backgrounds, from different countries, from different parts of the world, from different social classes. even if becoming an actual knight was supposed to be reserved for people of the upper classes, of the knightly ranks. So what are our Templars in Knightfall based on? Well, the one thing I love about the show is that we're always playing with Templar mythology at the same time as Templar history, and that is very clearly hinted at in the names of our heroes. So we have Landry, a man who's shacking up with the Queen, which seems to me a pretty obvious wink to the character of Lancelot in the Arthurian legends, which are all about knighthood and faith. Then we have Gawain. Does Gawain get a roar? No. Sam, my producer, is shaking his head. What can Gawain do? How about a moan from his injured leg? That's a good moan. Now, Gawain is definitely another familiar name from Arthurian myth. Sometimes, in Arthurian legend, he's portrayed as a master warrior. Other times, he's portrayed as a healer, which, in our case, for our Gawain, I suppose that's kind of ironic. But we'll come on and talk about that later. We've also met the recently bereaved Parsifal. Mary! Now, that's another Arthurian knight who in the 13th century was probably the name most closely associated with the legends of the Holy Grail. And then there's Tancred. Now, he's not from Arthurian legend. I think in this case, the writers in Knightfall were actually circling back to history. So in my mind, Tancred isn't so much an Arthurian character as a name deeply connected to the Crusades. And he takes his name, I think, from Tancred de Hauteville, one of the bravest and most famous of the warriors who went on the First Crusade, 1096 to 1099. So clearly there's masses of history here to pick through, as well as masses of legend. But how much of this, I wonder, is on the actors' minds as they put the season of Knightfall together? To answer that, I called our leading man... Thank you. ...to ask him how he researched his role.
Hi, Dan.
Hey, how you doing? Here's Tom Cullen. Like, do you do a lot of, you've done historical or sort of period-themed shows before. Do you do a lot of reading into the period, or are you more focused on what's in the script?
It's a balance, but the script doesn't come into play for me until later on in the process. I believe that if you are doing a historical piece, you have to bathe yourself in as much literature and as much information as possible. You have to be able to understand and build the world in your head. I think it's really important to understand the politics of the time, to understand the religious and social vibrations that are working.
What were you reading? What were you watching? Was there anything in particular that stood out that had represented this world before?
I read a couple of books, and I actually went to Paris with one book. I wish I could remember what it was called. My friend was filming in Paris at the time, and he'd been living there for about 3 months. And so I called him up and I was like, "Hey, dude, is it good if I can come and stay with you? Because I want to come and do this research trip and just kind of, I don't know." I was obsessed, you know, I was just really obsessed with understanding and feeling these guys. And I get a bit obsessed. And so I went to Paris to stay with him. And I hadn't seen him for a while. So the first night we went out for some drinks, and one drink turned into about 5, 6, and we ended up staying up pretty late. And I'd gone to bed and fallen asleep and woke up in the morning, like, without doing any kind of knowledge or research of where I actually was in Paris and where I needed to go. And there's this really great website, if ever you do go to Paris, it's called Secret Tours of Paris, which is a kind of bullet point of where you should go and then the history of what those places are. And there's a Templar one. And so... which I'd already previously found. So I kind of woke up in the morning in a bit of a hungover state and got my phone out and was like, right, okay, where do I need to be in Paris right now so that I can start this Templar tour?
Yeah.
And I got it up on my map and I put the address in. And I was like, holy shit. Like, it's right on my blue dot. Like, it's right where I am. And I was like, okay, so follow a second. So where is the temple? And I was sleeping on the ground of where the temple used to be. I've got goosebumps now because, you know, when you're trying to really get into the psyche of these men and you imagine what it must have been like for them, and it spooked me because I just felt like I was them. I don't know. It sounds crazy.
No, it sounds...
I really felt like these men were standing next to me. It's very cool.
So that's an incredible experience. It also tells us a little bit, doesn't it, about Paris today and the fact that you could have been asleep there and literally were right on top of the site of the temple and not know it. There's just nothing left, is there?
Absolutely nothing. No, Napoleon destroyed it because he didn't want it to become. I think he held the royal family there.
Yeah.
I think he raised it to the ground because he didn't want it to become a site for martyring.
Yeah.
Which is just tragic. What an idiot. Mm. No, but there's absolutely nothing left. There's a park there, and there's some kind of municipal buildings, and there's a really lovely market next to it. And there's this one big plaque which has a kind of outline of where it once was. It was huge. It was a huge site. And nothing. Absolutely nothing. The idea that these men and their exploits have been totally written off and wiped from the face of the earth is just awful. And, so sad.
Now, Gawain, expertly played by Porrig Delaney, injures his leg at the Siege of Acre while protecting Landry from a crossbow bolt. And I found out that Porrig's research into the character came a little more naturally.
My research in that respect, I mean, what I did, I looked up about medicine at the time, and there was kind of a paucity of medical science at the time, and you know, it was, you know, people would have had poultices and different things, but, and that made me think then Gawain would have relied even more upon God, and you know, it was all that. I think that's why people were, well, personally I think that's why people were so religious back then. It's not because of a lack of education or anything, it's simply we didn't have the kind of medical science that we do nowadays, and so you could get a saint or a god or a demon or whoever to kind of intercede on your behalf and make you better or prevent you from ill health. And I looked up a bit of that. But I don't know if you know this, but I was born with something called septic arthritis. I was literally popped out of the womb and they noticed something wrong with my leg.
Right.
And septic arthritis is a kind of arthritis that locates itself in one joint, and it's septic, so you constantly have to drain the joint. I had a bunch of operations when I was 6-8 weeks old, and for the first 6 months of my life I spent it in hospital.
Wow.
In Dublin, so my parents would have to travel up and down from County Wexford, it's about 120 kilometres, you know, to see me. So I spent the first 6 months of my life in hospital. And as a result of that, my right leg is now weaker, it's shorter. As we speak, I've got a heel raise in my right shoe, it's about an inch. So it's more than an inch shorter on my right leg. So I have kind of a real life painful experience that I can dwell upon. And you know, for the first day of filming, it was my inroad into Gawain was quite easy. I just took out my heel raise and I've automatically got a little bit of a limp.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, as
the guys we did an interview recently, and Tom and Simon, we literally in sync with each other went, "You were born to play Gawain."
Now, actually, although there wasn't so much in the way of penicillin, Advil, or knee replacements going around in the Middle Ages, we should probably be careful not to do down the medical sophistication of the time too much. Porrig's right to say that a lot of weight was placed on faith-based healing, in a way that today we'd often call homeopathic at best and superstitious at worst, but there's actually a huge amount of evidence for a thriving and serious medical profession in the Middle Ages. The Templar Rule is full of references to the infirmary, and that tells us that in the larger Templar houses at least there was a medical wing, and I guess you'd expect that when part of the job description was having armed battles with people who wanted to kill you. But in the wider world, there were also serious doctors and medical textbooks. One of the most famous medical research and treatment centres in the world was at Salerno in Italy, where doctors would treat you for everything from toothache or bad breath to an anal fistula. And I promise you I'm not making this up, diagrams for carrying out the procedure still exist. Now, luckily for Porrig and Gawain, his character has an injured leg and not a perforated colon. Anyway, put all that aside. While I was talking to Porrig, I asked him about the general physical demands on the actors of training to represent Templar knights, whose enemies described them as the fiercest fighters of all the Crusaders.
I remember we arrived on a Sunday night, and then straight away Monday morning we were into this boot camp situation, which is the best way to do it, kind of throw us in at the deep end. It's the best way to get to know each other. But we were immediately doing circuit training. I think it was 8 a.m. the next morning. A bit of weight training. And of course, there's lots of bravado going on, and you know, we're all trying to, you know, flex our muscles and all this kind of crack. But we're working with a team of stuntmen immediately, and women. You know, weapons training, weapons handling, fight safety, fight techniques. And it was really good that we were working with those stunt guys, because they were the fellas who we'd be fighting with on, you know, in the sequences. So you got to know them and respect them, and that's all quite important. We'd break then for lunch, and very healthy lunch, of course, you know, because you don't want to undo the work that you've done that morning. And then in Barrandov Studios, kind of nestled into one corner of the studios, they have this amazing stables where we'd go down, and we all had our own horse, and we do a little bit of trotting around the ring. And then after a few days, we were allowed to go out into this forestry, which runs around the side of Barrandov Studios. And it was just amazing. Just got to know our steeds, so to speak. I had Romeo. Seriously, that was his name. Romeo was, he was 23.
Come on.
Very old in horse years. And he had a habit of falling asleep standing up. So I really, earned my spurs on that, literally, because I was constantly digging the heels in, trying to get him to move. But, you know, he was fantastic, actually. All of the horses were fantastic. You could do anything and they wouldn't be spooked at all. I think the horses had more film experience than we did.
Now, that Nightfall boot camp sounds like a lot of fun, but I'd heard rumours that one actor threw himself into the training a little more earnestly than the others.
What, I'm 40 now, and you know, we're all a bit older, but Bobby was the youngest of the group.
Porrig's talking there about Bobby Schofield, who plays Parsifal.
And he was especially trying to flex his muscles, and he was practising this fight sequence with one of the stunt guys, and, you know, really throwing himself into it. It's, you know, and you didn't need it at that stage, you know, we were just practising. But I think he was trying to prove a point and, you know, show that he was a man like the rest of us. And at one stage, he threw himself into one fight particularly hard, and he got up and he looked quite shook. And he said, "Bobby, are you okay?" He said, yeah, I'm all right. Liverpudlian. And next thing he got a proper wheezing cough and a big gob of blood came up.
Incredible dedication from the lads there, and although I'm laughing, it's obviously way too much for a feeble historian like me to handle. But Tom Cullen seemed to feed off it.
When you have someone in a room like that, it just inspires you to make it harder and more real. You know, we all put ourselves through it, and you know, we all had our big injuries, you kind of have to really go for it in this. If you don't, you'll be caught out, I think.
That does all sound like incredible fun, and I suppose it also has its parallels in real Templar history too. Bernard of Clairvaux, the spiritual godfather of the order, said Templars had to be superbly trained in war. And as Tom was talking there, I started thinking about the New Temple in London, which from 1185 onwards was the official headquarters of the temple in England. Today you can still visit the temple. There's a beautiful round church there, originally built by the order. What you can't see anymore is that close by, roughly where the British Royal Courts of Justice stand today, is that there used to be a tournament field where the English Templars used to practice fighting and jousting. It's not hard to imagine that in an all-male environment where military discipline was enforced, things must have gone a bit too far at times. In fact, we know this must have happened because in the official rule of the Templars, they're extremely strict about what should happen if brothers are caught fighting. And the punishment for laying your hands on another brother in anger was to be expelled from the order. Or if it was a serious fight, then to be put in irons, which means basically locked in a dungeon in chains. So I guess with all that in mind, Bobby probably got off quite lightly. And overall, it seems pretty clear from talking to all three of our leading Nightfall Templars that in their world, the training made men of them. But since we don't need to create real-life Templar Knights for a historical drama, I wondered why they go through such a rigorous training regime. And I asked Tancred, Simon Merrells.
This was, you know, three purposes: to get us physically fit, to give us weapons training, and to get us into the world, just even skimming the surface of the world of these knights that we were playing, in as much as they were martial men. They knew how to handle swords from an early age, and they were riders. So we had horse lessons, we had riding lessons. But the third purpose, which was unspoken, but which happened, was that it bonded us. Because very quickly, when you're gasping on the floor, surrounded by your own weight and water that you've just expelled from your body, and you think you're at the last point, and then somebody says, come on, five more, you know, you're egging each other on. And, you know, after a very short time of that kind of thing, like a few days, 2 days stretches, it becomes, you go into another kind of time zone, and by the end of a week you're bonded and you're building vital friendships. So when we went into filming after we'd done that for a few weeks, it was invaluable because we had these shared experiences, we had these shared pains, we had these failures and these frustrations and then these successes behind us already. So it was great to start the job like that. And then of course we're, you know, in full real armor on our steeds about to ride into a scene. And we just look at each other with big grins on our faces, you know, not being able to believe how lucky we are, really.
You'll have heard in the first podcast episode the story of Simon taking a dip in the sea while charging to the boat on the very first day of Nightfall's filming. So while I had Simon on the phone, I needed to hear that story from the horse's mouth.
Well, it was very hot, Dan. It was very hot, and it was just too tempting. No, I'd like to say that was the truth, but in fact, it wasn't. It was, well, as you say, we were filming in the harbour in Dubrovnik, which doubled for the harbour of Acre with the Templar fortification, and we're leaving. We're being expelled from Acre. It's our last stronghold. It's a battle to the death. And in our story, we've added the extra element that we have to remove the Grail in a very heavy chest to which I'm chained, and on the other end of it is chained Gawain, played by the fantastic Padraig Delaney, and we battle our way through Mamelukes and Saracens. We come out of a secret tunnel from our stronghold, and we battle through these people. There are citizens being slaughtered. We're trying to save them as we're going, but it's vital that we get the Grail to the ship that is waiting at the other end of the pier jetty, sitting in the harbour. There are trebuchets going off. The sea's exploding with fiery catapults. And so we sprint along this jetty towards the boat, the ship that's waiting for us, and we run up the plank. We rehearse this about four times, and it goes perfectly. It's epic. We're slicing down Saracens as we go, and we're running up. And when it came to the take, of course, there are many, many extras in front of us running onto the boat, citizens who were saving as well. And they were perfect in every single rehearsal and ran onto the boat. And then we shot on after them and dumped the grail, cut, fantastic, except when it came to the take, two wonderful, and I'll never know why, extras decided to stop halfway up the up the gangplank onto the boat.
Oh, my God.
I ran up with all my momentum and my nearly 50 pounds of armor, plus carrying chained to the Holy Grail in a chest, overbalanced and fell into the sea. The small amount of the ocean, the sea between the ship and the pier, the jetty. And as I sank...
How deep was it?
As I sank, well... It was deeper than me. Let's put it that
right.
way.
So you're going right under the surface in all this armor.
I was submerged, and to be entirely honest, my first feeling was of relief, thinking, "Bloody hell, this is nice. This water is beautiful." I was so hot, and then I'm slowly falling through the water. The shafts of sun are coming through. It's a very beautiful thing, and then I realize, well. It is nice down here, but it's probably not the best place to be in armor. So very quickly, I forced myself. I grabbed the top of the jetty and I pulled myself up. But now, of course, I'm even more. I'm double the weight again because I'm soaked.
Wow!
And I just I pull myself up and I see Porrig's face desperately looking at me, going, "Dude, Simon, come on." Take my arm.
Sounds like Porrig was quite the hero, but apparently that's not the whole truth.
In the version that I had been telling until recently, I made myself out to be far more heroic than I actually was on the day because I said, yeah, immediately I was at the edge of the pier. I was shouting, Simon, brother, are you okay? But on the day, they kept the cameras rolling. So if you look at it, it's more of a case I'm standing there with my hands on my hip going, where the hell is Simon? I just let go of the chest which the grail was in because we're both chained to it. So I was like, I am not going down with that. Which is a good thing because I can't swim. But fair dues to Simon, I have to say, within 5 seconds, he was with that 20 kilos of costume. He had broken the surface of the water and he looked at me and as calm as you like, he said, I'm fine. And that was it. What a legend.
And he said, dude, you're so calm. But I knew I'd be fine. And then also from the side came one of the fantastic divers who they had waiting on the harbour, who then got under my arm and gave me that final push to get me out. And as I was standing on the jetty with everyone around me going, you're right. I said, yeah, I'm absolutely fine. Absolutely fine. Soaked. I had to get out of the armour to change costume. Obviously.
Of course.
And Douglas, our director of the first block, was on the other side of the harbour with a loudspeaker going, Simon, you all right? And I said, yes. And I'm waving. He said, all right, my next question is, can you do that 10 more times? And I did, of course. It took a little while to change into fresh costume, but that sequence is immortalized, and I can still say that it is it's an extraordinary memory, and it's extremely funny when you see these two glorious heroic knights charging along this pier, cloaks flying behind them, swords swaying, the grail in between us, and you see me running up this, and then I just disappear. It was quite an experience, and it's a tale that still gets told by nightfallers.
I'm very pleased and feel very privileged you've shared it with our podcasters as well. Now, I like to spot the little things in Nightfall. You'll remember we also touched on the tattoo last time behind Tancred's ear. I had to find out, where did it come from? What we've noticed as we go through the show is that there are certain bits to the show which, you know, you blink and you'll miss them, but they are intriguing in and of themselves. And one of them relates directly to Tancred, which is where did he get the cross tattoo behind his ear? I mean, I've got a theory that there's a tattoo parlor in Jerusalem that has been tattooing pilgrims since the year 1300. And so, you know, I've got my own theory about it. Can you set me straight?
Well, what we decided was that for me, it was in memory of Acre. It was after Acre because I didn't have it at Acre, at the Battle of Acre, or Acre, as some people might think of it. So it was a memoriam of that battle that I got on the return, on the long return to France from the Holy Land. Maybe I got it in Cyprus on a stopover.
Ayia Napa. I feel people today still get tattoos in Ayia Napa, I believe.
I believe they do. But I think as far as Douglas and Dominic and the team's inspiration for the idea, because it was put to me and I immediately said yes. Mm-hmm. Initially, it was going to be on my face. Because
really? Mike Tyson and you're going to,
well, it wasn't Tyson. It was, you're going to have to forgive me because I've forgotten the footballer's name, but there's a famous footballer from.
Simon's referring here to Portuguese soccer player Ricardo Quaresma, who has a cross tattooed on his cheek.
And they posited that, but it was deemed by production to be too much to have it on the face. So we decided just behind the ear where you find it. And I love the idea of it. Some ideas just click straight away, and I thought, yes, that is him.
Now, much as I love talking to our Templars, I want to hear from you too. Last week I was asked whether I got a part in the show, and the answer was no. I'm still waiting to hear about reshoots. Weirdly, they haven't been in touch. Why don't you get in touch instead? Search for Nightfall or History on Facebook and Twitter, or tweet using the hashtag Nightfall, and I'll do my best to address your questions here. All of which brings us to a close, but what's coming up next? Well, next time we'll be speaking to the regal Olivia Ross and Ed Stoppard, that's Queen Joan and King Philip, to hear all about playing the monarchs of Nightfall. Before we go, I know what you want. Let's have one more Landry roar. Go on. Thanks for listening. History's Nightfall podcast is presented by Dan Jones and produced by Sam Pearson for A&E Networks.